You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On the inaugural episode of the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on WPVC, outgoing Charlottesville City Councilor and Vice Mayor Dee Dee Smith talks about her journey as an elected official, what she learned while serving, and her advice to incoming councilors. This week's program is hosted by longtime Wake-Up Call producer Sean McCord, who will host the show once per month. Wake Up Call mainstay Rick Moore returns to the program next Sunday. WVPC 94.7 is a new FM radio station serving the Charlottesville area. Founded by Jeff Leonard and Rod Howard, the station plans to serve up a mix of progressive talk radio during the day and hip-hop music during the evening hours. Here's your host for today's program, Sean McCord.
It is WPVC-LP, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. This is Sean McCord and my guest, outgoing city council member, and that's all I'm going to call you from now on, Dee Dee. Outgoing city council member, Dee Dee Smith, because you are outgoing, and sadly you're also outgoing. But we'll.
Thank you, Sean. I am honored to be here.
Well, it is such a pleasure. This is my debut solo show here on the Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, and I was so pleased when you agreed to come in and be my guest. We have so much to talk about.
Oh, we do. It's going to be hard to fit it into an hour.
Oh, you have been such a figure in Charlottesville progressive politics, and we're actually going to talk about what progressive politics means in a few minutes. But a lot of people know your name. You've been on the city council for 4 years. You are currently our vice mayor,
right?
But you've also been involved in many issues that are important to you in the community. But let's pull the curtain back a little bit and talk about Dee Dee Smith, the person, and where you came from, and what your roots are, and what brought you here. You grew up. Well, tell me where you grew up.
I grew up in Birmingham, Michigan, a suburb of Detroit.
Birmingham, Michigan, not to be confused with Alabama.
No, nothing like it.
I've never heard of Birmingham, Michigan. What kind of town was it?
Oh, it was the All-American City. Mm-hmm. It was voted that at one point. It's, you know, Michigan's an interesting place to grow up because so many people there are transplants. The auto industry is very big, and so it's a lovely place to grow up. Actually, it was 15 miles north of Detroit.
Yeah.
Detroit at that time was kind of a fun place to go down to. I remember fondly going down to Hudson's at Christmas time and to Greek Town.
So back then, Detroit was like where you went to get your culture.
Yeah, well, sort of, yeah. I had a perfectly lovely childhood growing up there, but then left to go to University of Michigan. And I went at age 16.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I never went back to the suburbs.
Yeah.
I loved Ann Arbor. And that was my real growing up time. I was introduced to a lot of progressive politics in Ann Arbor, became very involved with things such as the Tenants Union, and some real sort of counterculture movements. And it was just a really fantastic time. I was there for 6 years. It took me a little while to graduate.
Well, so you started at 16, so you graduated at the right time.
I had some time, exactly. And I took a little time off, actually. Went out to California for a semester. But anyway, and I also lived with a group of friends that was centered with kind of the leader of this very large communal house, which again was another. This is the 70s.
Yeah,
this is the, you know, early mid 70s.
Right.
So very, very much kind of a still the 60s dragging on.
Mm-hmm.
But the center of this household was a woman who had polio when she was 3. In fact, she was a March of Dimes child, poster child. And but she was grown. She was in, like us, in our late teens, early 20s. And she wanted to live independently. She had to sleep in an iron lung. She had it. She
wow.
was really legally quadriplegic, incredibly sharp, one of the most fascinating people I've ever known in my life. But she was just very much about independence, and we just went on all sorts of adventures. But I lived with her for most of that 6 years. I was 1 year in a dorm, but mm-hmm. after that, we lived in a variety of these student houses in Ann Arbor. And that was it was such a pivotal point in my my life in terms of really looking at the world through a different set of eyes. And I think that time really shaped a lot of my future in civic activity and involvement and compassion, which I like to think I bring to the issues that I fight for.
Oh, I'm sure people would agree with that. You're listening to The Wake Up Call on WPVC-LP Charlottesville 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Sean McCord with my guest, outgoing city council member, T.D. Smith.
I'm so outgoing.
Let's go back to Birmingham.
Okay.
You probably didn't say that way. Birmingham.
Birmingham, you know, on my Midwest accent.
So you said it was just outside Detroit. Was this mm-hmm. Was it a big union town?
Oh, God. No, it was the suburbs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There's really nothing terribly exciting about Birmingham, Michigan. I went to Catholic schools. So I my mother was a Catholic. My father mm-hmm. was not. I'm a middle child of five children. There was nothing terribly dramatic about growing up in Birmingham, Michigan, other than it was very stable.
Sure.
And so it was a good foundation. I like to tell people growing up in the 60s in a place like Birmingham was very much like the Peanuts cartoon.
Right.
You know, we were free-range kids.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't call it that.
Before that was a thing, yeah.
Yeah, it was a very safe community.
We just called it playing.
Playing. We just called it playing. And there were never any adults around. Mm-hmm. particularly in the, what are now cartoons of Peanuts, the adults always have those squeaky little non-words. That's what it was like.
That really meant something to me, because when I was a kid, because I heard that, I thought, yeah, that's exactly what they sound like.
Exactly, when they were around.
Yeah.
You know, my parents didn't play with us. My gosh, you know, and we just played with each other, with the neighborhood kids.
And I don't know about you, but, you know, my dad worked, my mom was at home.
Absolutely.
Back before we had two-parent working families.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I always knew if I went home, my mom was there.
Right.
But I would spend as little time in the house as possible. And we don't need to go down this whole trip. I mean, I think, you know, I've got kids who are teenagers and young adults, and I see how they live now. And in many ways, they go, well, that's not the way it was when I was a kid. But there are also many things to be envious of.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we had Minecraft when I was that age, I would totally be doing that instead of being outside. So I totally get that, and I admire the way that they can stay connected, because, you know, you talk about people you went to college with.
Mm-hmm.
In our lifetime, really in our lifetime up until just a few years ago, you move on, you leave a town, you graduate college, you go to a different place, you completely lose touch with those people.
Yeah.
And I've had the experience, I'm sure you've had the experience too, of now being able to reconnect with people on social media. But my kids are growing up in an era where they never have to lose touch unless they intend to,
right.
They are building their own form of community. I just hope that these virtual communities don't replace the actual communities that we live in, places like Charlottesville.
Yeah, and there's lots of different ways to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how much to really hold on to one way or the other, because I certainly work with a lot of people who had very different upbringings. And I don't find that it really makes a huge amount of difference in what we actually do. I would say that my mother, who was the mother of the five, was an extremely strong woman, and she didn't work outside the home as much. She was a journalist and she worked within the home, but she was a great role model, and she used to tell us, "I am raising you to leave home."
Yeah.
You know, she was trying to, and there were two girls, three boys, and you know, we did all grow up to be very independent and make our own way. And it's, I do think there was something very, very pivotal about her role in the family. And, you know, like yourself, my father was an engineer, and he was a workaholic.
Right.
He loved to work, which is great. I mean, it's another great, you know, it's a good role model to love what you do. But really, pretty much, it was my mother who was the major influence in with these kids. But let's sort of move on a little bit to Charlottesville.
Well, yeah, so you came to Charlottesville in 1979.
Yes.
What brought you here?
Well, first of all, after in Michigan, I got a degree in microbiology. I love science.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about majoring in math. I mean, that's just the way my mind works. And I spent a year in Germany at the Max Planck Institute for Biology in this beautiful little town south of Stuttgart that hadn't been bombed in World War II.
Right.
It was celebrating its 900th birthday the year I was there.
It pays to be, you know, when we talk about how old our town is. You know, and we've got buildings here that are 200 years old. It gives us some perspective.
It's a lot of perspective.
In many ways, we're still adolescents.
It's true. It's true. And it was an absolutely fantastic experience. I was there at the sort of birth of the immunogenetics arena, which is what I studied at Michigan. I worked for a transplant surgeon. And in fact, one of my favorite stories is when Nixon resigned, the night Nixon resigned, I was watching a kidney transplant. We're listening to Nixon resigning. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Other than I mention that because that's the foundation of a lot of what I bring to my civic activities, which is a very strong science background.
Sure, you're interested in facts, and you're interested in data.
Exactly, and I'm well known for that.
Yes,
it drives some people.
Yes, you are
crazy.
Well, some people just some people just don't like facts.
Yeah. I know. Well, you know, we can get into that too, because it has been quite a theme in my city council years. But what brought me to Charlottesville is my to-be husband at the time, who we were together in Michigan, and he got his PhD in psychology from University of Michigan, and he was coming to University of Virginia as an assistant professor, kind of through Duke. He first had his first job at Duke while I was in Germany, et cetera. So we were reuniting in Charlottesville, and that's what brought me to Charlottesville was my to-be husband. But what was interesting is that there weren't very many places in the United States at this point that immunology was big.
Right.
University of Michigan was one of them, and University of Virginia was another.
Very good.
This is a hotbed for immunology. So it was a really good place for me to come, and that's what I did. I worked in research in immunology and rheumatology, as it turns out, which is very related, for a number of years, and, you know, Tim and I got married, and we had children, and I transitioned from lab work, which I was sort of becoming a bit tired of, to environmental work.
Right, and I think that's what people know you for the most.
Right.
But to go from being interested in the environment and becoming an activist, a public activist for the environment, how did that transition happen?
Well, that was interesting because I certainly got my roots in environmental knowledge and background and really the depth of the issues through my environmental education work at the Ivy Creek Natural Area.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the director for a time, for 14 years, which is a time. And we did a lot of environmental education, and I just got to know everybody in the community because that's what Ivy Creek Natural Area is.
Right.
It's the Ivy Creek Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
I was the executive director of the Ivy Creek Foundation, and it was the hub of everything happening that was environmental, particularly around education and stewardship. And so while I was there, we did a couple really important things. One was we built the education center out there, and that just cemented the Ivy Creek Natural Area as the place where everybody gathered. We allowed any environmental group to use this beautiful little building. If you've never seen it, you should just go out there and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the most precious building, very, very green. But very sweet. And we built that building, and we allowed any environmental group to use it for free for meetings, and everybody did. It was very busy. That was actually took on a life of its own. Another thing we did was to create the Ragged Mountain Natural Area.
Yeah.
And it was owned by the city. It was our original reservoir, 1880s, had a lot of history in it, but 900 acres of city-owned land that was completely unmanaged and was bearing the brunt of not mismanagement, but lack of management. So Dan Beaker was the president of the foundation at the time. We were like the dream team.
Right.
You know, we built that building together, and then took on creating the Ragged Mountain Natural Area, and so it really became this great resource for the community, as in terms of being a very quiet and very wildlife sanctuary like place. But that's where my activism began, because it's well known that it became the subject of the site for the future water supply.
Right. Ragged Mountain looms large in your legacy. I'm talking to Dee Dee Smith on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on WPVC-LP Charlottesville, 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, PVC. This is Sean McCord. And we've been a little remiss, Dee Dee, in not mentioning somebody very important to you and I and to our community as a whole, who left us this week. I'm talking, of course, about
Francis Fife. Yes.
Yeah. And so this is probably right around the time when your paths first crossed, right?
Well, it certainly was when we first got to know each other really well. Francis Fife was instrumental in founding the Ivy Creek Natural Area.
Yeah.
He was mayor at the time, right. The 1970s. He was very instrumental in getting the Ravana Water and Sewer Authority created, which they kind of had to do. It was sort of forced, you know, a forced authority. But he was instrumental in making sure that that worked well for the city. The South Fork Ravana Reservoir was created at that time under his leadership. And so we certainly had that tie with the Ivy Creek Natural Area. But when the Ragged Mountain Natural Area became threatened to be clear-cut and flooded, Francis was one of the first to step up to a group that we created called Citizens for a Sustainable Water Plan. And because Francis was a true environmentalist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of a term that I've come to really, really feel deeply about, who is an environmentalist and who is not. And he, even from the beginnings of Ivy Creek, he was a real hands-off, and I say no, a human-off. I mean, he really thought that the Ivy Creek Natural Area maybe shouldn't even have a parking lot.
Right.
You know, it is a precious place that is very valuable in a natural way. But he contended afterwards that, no, it was a good idea to put a parking lot in there. And when we proposed this building, he was a little suspicious. But he came around because he saw that it could fit in nicely to this natural area. But with Ragged Mountains, a whole different scene.
Mm-hmm.
Because Ragged Mountain Natural Area, 900 acres of city-owned land, contiguous with a lot of other undisturbed forest of called a chain of the Ragged Mountains, it's immensely ecologically valuable, much more so than Ivy Creek Natural Area. Because it's a bowl, it's protected.
Mm-hmm.
It has been a site for eons of nesting of our local songbirds. And it was shown to be by a Smithsonian study done back in 2002. They actually came to Central Virginia, looked at eight natural, beautiful, naturally protected places, and Ragged Mountain Natural Area was the best for the nesting success of their indicator species, which was the wood thrush, which we have in Charlottesville, although I haven't heard much of it since they clear cut.
I will confess, I'm not much of a birder, but even I have heard of the wood thrush. It is 11:20 a.m. on Sunday. It's the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. This is Sean McCord talking with Dee Dee Smith, and we're taking just a moment to talk about our friend Francis Fife,
okay.
Who was an institution here in Charlottesville, a true Southern gentleman who would stand up when a lady came in the room, and yet also fiercely liberal, an advocate for the environment, an advocate for housing, former mayor of Charlottesville, his wife, Nancy O'Brien. We extend our condolences to her and his entire family. And to me, he was always kind of the epitome of Charlottesville. And for those of you, I'm sure most people listening in now know, but we lost Francis on Friday.
Yes.
At 95 years old. And, you know, you hear he was 95, it's like, oh, gosh, yeah. You know, I guess when you have to think about things like that when you're 95. But he's been around. He just sort of seemed like he would always be around and be here forever.
I know. It's so sad.
It hasn't even really settled in yet. Mm-hmm. That we're just not going to be, you know, we're going to have a Francis Fife-shaped hole in our community for a long time to come. But he did so much for us. And in many ways, I think you are positioned to carry on his legacy.
Oh, thank you. And that was so beautifully said. I really, really appreciate that. He was always a staunch supporter of my political life, he having had such a long political life. You know, and it's important to say he was sharp as a tack to the very end.
Absolutely.
My gosh, what an inspiration he always was. He also lived in our part of town. Mm-hmm. You know, you and I live on the south side of town, and
he lived
in the Fife household.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's important to note that Francis Fife is the Fife of Fifeville.
Fife of Fifeville, that's right.
Yeah, he had very, very deep roots here in Charlottesville. His grandfather, I believe it was his grandfather, if I've got my generations right, was one of the first pastors of the First Baptist Church on West Main,
mm-hmm.
the African-American Baptist Church, when
mm-hmm.
it was first created in 1865, or 1863 even, maybe.
Get your dates right.
I know, get my dates right. I might be 2 years off. But it was actually 1865 because they just celebrated their 150th anniversary.
That's right.
And his ancestor was a traveling pastor, a minister,
mm-hmm.
and they had to have a white minister in the beginning. They weren't allowed to have a black minister.
Right.
Later, it was William Gibbons, who's now has a dormitory named after him. Brand new dormitory, who was the first black minister. But so Francis's roots are so deep in this community. He loved this community so much.
Yeah.
But he was a true blue, as you say, progressive, environmentalist, housing advocate, as you know, social justice advocate. And I certainly carry a lot of his cause in me, because we did have very strong ties, and I will deeply, deeply miss him.
As will we all.
So it's but all the more to carry on his legacy.
Absolutely.
And I do plan on doing that, even though I won't be on city council. I plan on carrying on his vision.
And we'll get back to your exit from city council in a minute. But let's talk a little bit about Charlottesville. I've been here 25 years, which means I'm still considered fairly new. You've been here since 1979.
I'm 36, yeah, 36 years.
And one of the things about this city, you know, my wife and I came here from New York. It was kind of a fluke that brought us here. And I think we both would have been surprised to find out that we'd still be here 25 years later. But I read something recently that I think explains the draw of this town, and that this is an intentional community. People take genuine pride in what we do here. So it may seem like we spend, you know, an endless amount of time arguing about, you know, the width of sidewalks and bike lanes and highways through parks and reservoirs and things like that. But it's because we take such pride in our community. And I think that Charlottesville, I mean, it's fantastic that we have and have had people like Francis Fife, who can trace his, you know, roots here, you know, 150 years. But I think we also benefit from people who come from elsewhere who have seen the kind of damage that can be done to communities if you don't pay attention, if you can't strike that balance between businesses and people, between, you know, between church and community and all the other aspects that make a community a community. And it is a struggle here.
Yeah.
And you know, we've had some setbacks, but I think we've also made some progress, and I think you've been an important part of that. So when you came on, tell us about, let's jump ahead a little bit.
Okay.
And talk. We'll take a break in a few minutes on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC LP, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. But let's jump ahead a little bit in what first drew you to the idea of running for city council.
Well, I have, first of all, I'll tell you the real genesis of my political activities, my community civic activities here was when I put my first child in kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you're in the Johnson School District, I'm in the Jackson Bias School District, and you know, these are relatively high poverty schools. I come from a suburb. It was not a natural inclination of mine. Just didn't feel, you know, immediately comfortable to do this with my first child. But through a series of friendships, et cetera, I did. And I loved that school. But I immediately saw the inequity in our schools, in a real big imbalance, a lot of what appeared to be just some old-time Southern politics going on. And I was politicized at that point. You know, I had some roots in Ann Arbor with political action. Hadn't really continued with that immediately here in Charlottesville, but I became a real watchdog. I became quite notorious. I think I attended school board meetings. Mm-hmm. I fought and advocated for the Southside schools fiercely. They, you know, it was a real thorn in their side. But I did ultimately, was appointed to the school board.
And that was back when the school board was appointed.
Yeah, it was back when it was appointed, mm-hmm. right? And which, at you know, and you can debate whether appointment or election is the better way to go. There was a lot more balance when it was appointed because the city council could actually take things into consideration in making sure that there was representation. And I'll tell you, since it became an elected school board, we have had almost no representation on the south side of Charlottesville. Yeah, it's shocking, actually. There's 7 school board members, not a single one lives in the districts of 3 of our 6 elementary schools. So, but that's, you know, that's, here I go with my political stuff. But
And I want you to. But we're gonna take a little break. It is 30 minutes after the hour on 94.7 WPVC LP, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
And you're listening to WPVC 94.7, where you get tomorrow's big gay news today. If you want to be part of one of our new radio stations here in Charlottesville, please drop us a line at 947WPVC.org or hit us up on Facebook. You can even come by our studio at 255 Zan Road in Seminole Square. We need board ops. We need people to sit here and do the hardcore switching, read the weather, and be on the air. If you think you can do those things, please let us know. And now back to Sean McCord in Sunday Morning's Wake Up Call, who's interviewing City Councilor Dee Dee Smith.
That is outgoing City Councilor Dee Dee Smith. We've been talking for half an hour, and we haven't even talked about your time on the council yet. So you're leaving council at the end of this year.
I am.
We'll get back to that. what would be your advice for the new incoming City Council members?
Well, you know, it's fascinating to me because I came on to City Council, and I'll tell you the how I got on City Council is all Dave Norris's fault. He had been bugging me for years and years as I was fighting this water supply issue that to join up and to go, you know, to run for election. I kept telling him, I've made a lot of trouble, Dave.
Yeah.
I just don't know if I'm even electable. But it was a very hot issue, and I was very well known. So it did work at that time. And I came in with my, you know, very long record of civic activity. People knew what I stood for. I was very honest about it. Environmentalism, educational equity, social justice. But you know what? You can come in with any issues you want, but you're going to be presented with a whole platter of things you had no idea existed.
Right. You can be an expert or an advocate in one particular area, but once you're on City Council, you have to know a whole lot about everything.
And you have to make decisions about them.
About things that that aren't necessarily in your background.
Exactly. So, and so my advice is get ready. Because you need to read hundreds of pages of material, some of which you will be able to absorb, others of which you're going to need some really sort of background history. Have a group of folks that you trust. Mm-hmm. You'll sort of build, a whole list of people that might know something about the issues that are before you, because it is a very, a very important responsibility, and not everybody takes this responsibility seriously.
Yes, I think we've seen some examples of that in the past.
Yeah. But it's important, and what's another shocking thing coming onto council was I know an awful lot of people in this town, mm-hmm. and I know a lot of the staff, and all of a sudden, you're a completely different person. I mean, not to yourself.
Right.
But you're just talking to somebody, and you realize that they're talking to you in a different way because you're a city councilor.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to really wake up to having that new persona and that new, again, it's kind of a moral responsibility. You have to be careful, and people are going to be careful with you. And you just need to recognize that you do have this power that is precious, and it's also it's just also really something you have to be very, take a real sort of moral perspective
on. Sure, because you're making it's got to be personal, because you're making a transition from a private citizen to a public figure.
Yeah.
And it's not, you're not just on city council when you're in the chamber. But when you're when you're walking down the downtown mall, when you're shopping in the grocery store, when you're dropping your kid off at school, people are going to come up to you, and you represent the city, but you also represent them. So in your 4 years on the council, you were known for facts and figures.
Yes.
And trying to keep things straight. You were telling me in our pre-show discussion about your infamous spreadsheet. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yes. Now, one of the things I found very useful, it took me a little bit to figure this out, but I kept, continue to keep an Excel spreadsheet of all the items that we discuss at City Council.
Mm-hmm.
I had sometimes add to it things that happened outside of City Council as well, which is important. But the reason I do it, and I really just pretty much copy and paste it into an Excel spreadsheet, is so that I can remember, for one thing.
Sure.
If I need to refer back to something, I can search it. But really to get a sort of bigger perspective on what you do as a city councilor, because I talk a lot about this, and new councilors will be asked to talk about what they're doing. And what was really surprising to me, because I code them, each of the items, as to whether it's parks or taxes or administration, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the first year on council, which was 2012, was just horrendous in terms of the sheer number of issues. And but parks and housing were the two big ones.
In terms of the amount of attention.
Yeah, the amount of the number of agenda items that we considered, voted on, discussed. It was heavily weighted. Wasn't as much true in the following years. We did a lot of development issues,
right.
PUDs, SUPs. And again, I'm just an information person. So
sure.
I find it interesting. I actually, in preparation for this show, I just went back to look at how many SUPs, which is a special use permit.
Thank you.
That's what brought us the flats.
Mm-hmm.
It's what brought us all that West Main development. A lot of the development that people complain about came through special use permits. And there were 13 of them in 2013.
And a special use permit, just to clarify, is when we have our policies, we have our regulations. When you build a building, this is the process. These are the kind of structures you can build. And then people come to the city council and say, well, those are really good, but we want to do this. And it's different than your guidelines.
Exactly.
And then there is some discussion. They have to make a justification for that. So there were 13 SUPs.
In 2013 alone. And that was really the height of the special use permit. That's a lot.
That's more than once a month. You have to start to question, why do we have these guidelines if we're granting all these exceptions to it? Were there any special use permits that were denied?
There were, actually, but most of them are approved.
Most of them are approved.
And PUD is the other one, Planned Unit Development. We've seen that on the south side a lot. You've got one right behind Johnson Village.
Yes, that's huge.
And one next to Johnson Village that's huge. We saw a lot of those for a while. And again, these are important decisions. And when you see them, when you start sort of sorting out how many there are and when they are and, you know, et cetera, I think it does lend a broader perspective on city council matters and should give some, sort of greater depth to and breadth to the decisions that we make. But it's, it was sort of fun. It's fun to go back and really look over the years and see what issues were big and what the city council, my city council career looked like. And it's shocking, really. I mean, if you think about it, first of all, my second meeting as a city councilor was on the fight that I was fighting for 5 years. So that was huge.
We're talking about the Ragged Mountain Reservoir.
The Ragged Mountain Reservoir. It was the water supply plant. A lot of it had been decided, although there were still major decisions to be had. And I felt both lucky for the issue to still be on the table, but also it's discouraging because it's, you know, it was a 3-2.
Time and time again.
I mean, there were lots of votes to be had. I made a motion at the time that council use only updated the latest updated information in this decision, and it was denied.
Because facts are inconvenient sometimes.
They were so inconvenient to this particular issue, and a lot of the predicted outcomes are in fact playing out, and you might think that you're sort of vindicated, but it doesn't feel that way.
So how did that feel? To young Dee Dee Smith from 4 years ago.
I know.
You know, you were known for your work in Ragged Mountain and the water supply plan, and you come on the board, and was your second vote?
Second meeting.
Your second meeting. And this thing that you have fought so hard for, and it just goes down.
Yeah, it was so discouraging. You know, Dave Norris was still on the council at the time, and he had always been a strong advocate for this particular fight.
And really, you were elected because that's what you were known for.
Right. And a large part of that election was this issue, as well as some other environmental issues, Meadow Creek Parkway, and the YMCA, certain other ones that there was a whole bunch of people who wanted them and a bunch of people who didn't. And I was really carrying that message.
Right.
And was the real voice of that, but it was a 3-2. And between Dave and I think we made 15 motions to try to make this situation better. And every single one of them was denied 3-2, including using updated information, including trying to save city resources or getting the city to be compensated even for what they were losing. And we lost so much in that one decision. And that one decision has had the biggest impact on the last 4 years of any decision I can remember in my 36 years. Are so many natural resources have really been devastated with that one. So it was discouraging. But at the same time, it was less frustrating than being in the audience, which I had been in for 3 years before.
At least you got your voice heard.
And could make those 12 motions and made sure they were in the minutes, and anybody can go back and look verbatim at every one of those motions. And that was a fight, too, because the minutes didn't necessarily spell out the motions. And so I always read the draft minutes, always. That's another thing that I'm sort of known for.
And that's more advice that you
pass
on.
That's more advice that I read the minutes because I know myself and a lot of people like me and in my circles go back and read those We use those for research. So it's really important that those minutes are right. And I almost always have some correction to them. I mean, they've all been recorded, of course. So, you know, you can go back and listen to them, too. That's another piece of advice. The other issues that came up that first year, interestingly, were like the Human Rights Commission, the, you know, Belmont Bridge, the stormwater utility was beginning to be discussed at that point. The downtown mall was a big issue. The strategic investment area, which has been, you know, a lot of these have carried on, but that first year there was so much that came across our table, the dais, that demanded a lot of. It was a full-time job, and people used to ask me that all the time. It is absolutely a full-time job.
That was actually going to be one of my questions. I mean, you do so much. I'm talking to Dee Dee Smith on the Sunday morning wake-up call on WPVC LP Charlottesville 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Sean McCord talking to outgoing city councilor Dee Dee Smith, and I think that's something that people who haven't served on these kinds of positions may not fully appreciate. Now, when you first got on the council, I was wrapping up my last term on the Parks and Recreation Board, which is an appointed board, not an elected one, thank goodness. And we used to wrestle with these issues, and parks are so important to the community. It's really, you know, when you think of, you know, when you think of towns, you know, when you step outside of housing and schools, parks embraces so much. It is our public spaces. And we used to wrestle with these things back and forth and get presentations and have discussions and hold public meetings. And sometimes you would put a stake in the ground and fight for something and lose. And even then, we weren't actually voting on anything. We were making recommendations to the city council, and you all would have to have those discussions in some cases all over again. And it, you know, when you feel really deeply about something, it feels very personal when things don't go your way, even though that's the democratic process in action, and we all support that. It kind of wrenches you a little bit when you know when I look at some of the things that I fought for and that aren't here anymore because, you know, I just wasn't strong enough advocate for it.
You know, and that's interesting because this comes up with the Planning Commission a lot.
Right.
The Planning Commission is a very important board that takes a tremendous amount of time, and it's really their meetings last for hours, hours and hours, but they're also, and this actually was a change that happened since I've been on council, is they used to have actually power to do yay or nay on certain projects, and their power was stripped by the state. It was by the state. To be only advisory. So a lot more times than in the past, the city council decisions have this recommendation from the Planning Commission as opposed to only coming to city council if it was appealed. And it's shocking to me how many times we overturn Planning Commission recommendations. And yet they continue to put in tremendous amounts of time. I mean, these are a real sort of amazing civic servants, civil servants, whatever, that despite the fact that they have no confidence that city council will abide by their decisions. Now, it's interesting to hear you talk about Parks and Rec Advisory Board, something that I've been interested in. I was actually interested in getting a city councilor on that and just sort of didn't follow through with that. But we don't hear a lot about the recommendations of the Parks and Rec
You mean on city council or in general, really?
Yeah. So that could be something that you and I could work on.
I'm not on the board anymore. I served my two terms, but we certainly had members of the public who would show up for these things. It's true. As a board member, when I was on the board advisory board, I was never called to city council. I think we were just, you know, we gave our recommendations to the Parks and Rec staff, Brian Daly and all the excellent people who work for him, and then they would bring it to city council. Maybe there does need to be more.
Maybe there needs to be more communication between the Parks and Rec Advisory Board and city council. Because we have had, I mean, in my 4 years, parks have been a huge, just a huge issue, which is, again, the sort of one of the best parts of my last 4 years and some of the worst.
Right, right, because that has, has a, you know, buildings and parks, you know, that has sort of, you know, you get a reminder every day when you go to a park, when you drive down a street and you look at a particular building and you went, oh, I really wish that had gone a different direction.
Yes, exactly.
Oh my goodness! Look at the time, Didi. We've only got like 12 minutes
left.
It's like 11:48 a.m. on October. I believe this is the 18th. We're on Sunday morning wake up call on 94.7 WPVC LP, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Okay, let's talk about. Let's have fun and of all the things that happened under your watch as City Council, we've talked about some of the important. What was the most ridiculous thing that you were called on to do as a council member or as a City Council?
Gosh, how do I choose? But there was one.
Well, you got your spreadsheet.
This one that stands out. This was just funny in how just, you know, horrifying it was. And it was my first year, 2012, relatively early on, we were asked to City Council to make a decision as to whether to put a traffic light at Mickey Drive and Hydraulic.
Okay.
And as part of this decision, we were given reams of traffic data. You know, and thinking of this, I'm not a traffic engineer. There isn't a single traffic engineer sitting up here. Why are we being asked to do what our traffic engineer should do?
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a long time to realize that, in fact, we haven't had a traffic engineer for a long time. We actually had somebody in the role, but she wasn't a traffic engineer. She was actually, her degree was in health administration.
When you say we haven't had a traffic engineer, do you mean on staff?
On staff. We're supposed to have a traffic engineer, but Jeannie Alexander was the one who was just outgoing at that point.
Right.
She was leaving the position. I think she had already left. I don't think she was there when I was on council at all. And I don't know if that's why we were being asked, but it was just a ridiculous idea that we could make this decision. It should be a recommendation to us based on an expert's analysis.
Or some kind of advisory board.
It was sort of fun to discuss, you know, but you're just making it up at that point, you know, talking about the turn from 250 to Hydraulic. We've all done it a million times.
Right. When you're not an engineer, you have to say, well, let me see, when I was in my Prius and the last time I was making a left turn there and there was a truck in front of me.
Yeah. This is my experience.
Mm-hmm.
You should never make a decision based on your own experience.
Yes.
No matter how important we think we are,
I'm thinking,
it is limited.
I'm thinking of the constant arguments I see about raising the speed limit on the bypass.
Yes.
The 250 bypass, when it approaches downtown, it slows down to 35.
Mm-hmm.
And every few months it comes up. It's like, why on earth is this 35 miles an hour? The street is capable of, you know, people can drive much faster than that. People do drive much faster than that. And so I think it came to the City Council again just a few months ago, and not for the first time. Yeah. And you look at the data and you get the recommendations from the traffic engineers and you go, that's what it has to be. Mm-hmm. But people are so convinced because they drive it every day and nobody drives 35 miles an hour. I certainly don't want to. Why can't I be allowed to drive 45 there? But again, this is where facts come in. Facts can be inconvenient.
They can be. And the other really, really important thing to remember is that your decisions have consequences.
Right.
That are unintended consequences that you may or may not even have any information to predict, but somebody does.
Mm-hmm.
And, it is the unintended consequences that most often get us into trouble when decisions are not made using good information.
It's a Sunday morning wake-up call, 94.7 WPVC-LP, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm talking fast because we're running out of time. Is there one that stands out for you, Dee Dee?
Well, there is. I was, Let's talk about the most surprising.
Yes, let's talk about
this
the most
This is a fun one because by far the most surprising decision that we made was to pass an anti-drone resolution. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It seemed like a no-brainer. It really had very little immediate consequence for Charlottesville.
And remind us what the text of that resolution was.
It was very brief, mm-hmm. actually, and it was basically saying that we were putting a moratorium on any local use of drones by our police enforcement mm-hmm. For 2 years until such time that there were regulations developed around them, because that's what was happening. The technology was happening so quickly. And, you know, John Whitehead from
the Rutherford Institute.
Rutherford Institute was weighing in on this. There were a lot of really good people who mm-hmm. know their stuff who were saying, look, this is a dangerous thing across the nation. We have no power over them, right. But we do have power to say something locally, and that's a lot right. of our resolutions are sort of meaningless.
And we're not Luddites. We're not anti-technology. Yeah. It was a case of, you know, this technology is advancing faster than the civic discussion.
Exactly.
So let's just keep our skies clear and take a breath and have a little bit more time to discuss this and kind of see what the consensus is in a couple of years.
And it was just a statement. And a lot mm-hmm. of resolutions are just statement. It did actually have a little teeth, but not a lot.
But it was surprising
because we were apparently the first city ever anywhere to do this, and we got international mm-hmm. attention. We literally got phone calls at home from other countries.
Yeah. Yeah.
And from across the nation, we were on the radio, we were on the TV. It was actually a blast. But it was just like, we had no idea when we were passing this that there was anything really of any significance to anybody else that would be used. And yet, it was apparently a highly significant thing to do. So that was the most surprising thing that we did. In terms of a sort of the most rewarding,
please. Let's move to that.
And that is actually a really a hard one to say because there really has been a lot of positive and a lot of things I'm very, very proud of. I ran on them in my election, so you can just go back and look at that. But the most rewarding really was parkland, the acquisition of parkland locally in our city and mm-hmm. contiguous with our city.
Mm-hmm.
With particularly pieces that have both natural value, but also historic value. And again, in our part of town, we acquired the Fry's Spring.
Right.
There's two of them, actually. The historic springs that at one time were considered the third most efficacious mineral springs in the world.
You know. Back when people used words like efficacious.
I know. And back when they probably didn't know where a lot of them were. But you know, that's got enormous historic value. We yeah. bought the land that the remnants of the Hartman's Mill
right.
are on. There's a Hartman's Mill Road, just like there's a Fry's Spring neighborhood. That was like 20 acres, and that was just golden. But it was about 100 acres in all.
Mm-hmm.
We got more of the original quarry.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I've got a great passion for local history and a great passion for parkland. So these two together have been just a really great, I'd say, rewarding part of my council life. And I do feel like I had a role in really advocating for it. I made very sure that the money that we got for the land at Ragged Mountain, which wasn't enough, but it was enough to buy some more land, went back to comparable land, and comparable being of natural and historic value. So I'm very proud of that, and that was, you know, one of the things I will continue to look back on as nice. But at the same time, interesting, the most disappointing is parkland.
Yeah, well, right. It's two sides of a sword, isn't it?
Yeah, because even though we acquired about 100 acres, or at least added 100 acres of parkland to our system, we lost much more.
Yeah.
In not only in parkland itself, but in natural resources. Our natural resources have unfortunately been devastated in the last 4 years based on some of these votes that have had kind of a domino effect. We lost a lot of parkland in McIntyre Park, not only to pavement, but we basically just recently gave some away for private development, basically, which is, you know, the YMCA, but it's still private development. And, of course, Ragged Mountain.
The famed YMCA, which still hasn't broken ground yet.
No, but November, they've got a breaking ground date now. I just got it in the mail in early November. Again, all the information we have does not look favorable for the viability of this project, which I argued, look at the information. You know, they're closing them in D.C. because of competition. We have enormous amount of competition here. All the examples we were given were not comparable.
And just for the record, you're not against having a YMCA in town.
But the
whole idea of handing over public parkland.
And public money.
Right.
There's a lot. We're $1.25 million in cash that taxpayers are subsidizing competition to our own facilities in our parkland. So that and the, quite frankly, the rivers, we have had some devastation to our rivers, again, due to some of these decisions. And I think we need to be better stewards. And that's my message to future councils is take ownership of decisions and let's try to redeem ourselves for some of the loss of these natural resources. And I think Francis Fife would be the first one up there
Absolutely.
Saying that.
He would be. We've got just a little less than a minute left. I'm sorry that our phones aren't working yet. I wanted to act as kind of an audience advocate for people calling in. There's so many more things we could have talked about. So will you come back sometime?
I would love to. I'm just so excited by the inauguration of this fantastic new station, as well as the others here. And this is a co-op, right?
WPVC is part of the Virginia Radio Co-op. Four new stations that are launching more or less simultaneously. We've got a hip-hop station. We've got a rock and roll station. We've got Jeff Leonard, who you heard speaking earlier, is calling first generation classic rock,
i.e.
the stuff that you and I grew up with, right?
Excited.
And WPVC 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call with Sean McCord talking to Dee Dee Smith, the outgoing city council member. Dee Dee, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. The quality of Charlottesville life just went up.
And I am going to do my best. I'm going to vamp a minute, actually. Dee Dee, I got to press a button here and not play tomorrow's big gay news. This is what I was afraid of. Dead air for a moment. I don't even know where the keyboard is. Dee Dee, while I'm over here trying to figure out what buttons to push, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you know of your post-council plans?
Oh, thank you. I'm excited to get back into some of the arenas that I had to give up because of this full-time job as a city councilor, including an exciting project that I've started on local history. And you know what my big dream is, Sean, is I would like to put a audio app-like local history interpretive audio tape on our trolley. It goes through the most historic parts of Charlottesville. I would love you to be able to tune in as you're riding the trolley and learn about the historic landscape buildings that you pass. I mean, think about Downtown Mall, West Main, UVA. Mm-hmm. I mean, wouldn't that be fun?
All right. You hear that? Local app developers, I know many of you personally because I'm...
Come talk to me.
Yeah. Come talk to Dee Dee Smith. I think this sounds like a fabulous idea.
And besides that, I'm going to get back into my environmental activism. I was one of the founders of the Ravana Master Naturalists. I have had to give up that, which I was very involved with, and I look forward to getting back into that and back on the trails.
Excellent. Dee Dee, thank you so much. We'll see you back here again next year. You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call with Sean McCord on 94.7 WPVC LP, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.